Hello, and welcome to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne here at 88.5 KRFY, community radio for North Idaho. I am Dr. Joanne, and I hope you'll enjoy the medical topics I've chosen to present at 8 a.m. the first Monday of every month. If you missed the first Monday, the show is rebroadcast at 8 a.m. on the third Monday. You can not only listen to our shows on your radio at 88.5, but you can also stream this show and every show at krfy.org. In fact, if you'd like to stream KRFY from any place in the world, you can also do that. The show is available by podcast also at our link, krfy.org, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. The monthly topics discussed here will feature the medical designations for each month. Since this is May, today's show features National Mental Health Month, a topic that spans all ages and is certainly creating a lot of discussion. I have two guests here with me today, Joseph Wassef, PhD, and
Rob Rossi.
Rob Rossi.
LCSW.
Who's also, you are actually working though for Kinnick-Sue. You're placed where you are in Boundary County from?
Yep, I'm a therapist with Kinnick-Sue working in the schools in Boundary County.
Very good. Well, Susie, I also have Susie Perez here with me today. She's from the Real Morning Show, and I call her my executive producer.
Good morning, Dr. Joanne. I just want everyone to know that Medical Musing has already gained many listeners, and the subjects and interviews are timely and very interesting. Looking forward to this one today. So thank you for bringing vital and informative medical information to the KRFY airwaves. I wanted to let the listeners know a little bit about you, Dr. Joanne Royan, a longtime volunteer here at KRFY as a broadcaster, and now hosting your own show, Medical Musing with Dr. Joanne, airing the first and third Monday of the month at 8 a.m. So who are you, Dr. Joanne? Let me tell the listeners. Dr. Joanne is a retired pediatrician who has lived in Sandpoint since 2010. She previously worked in a pediatric practice in Columbus, Ohio for over 30 years and then covered at Sandpoint Pediatrics. As the media spokesperson for Central Ohio Pediatric Society, she contributed to print, online media, radio, and television. So you have a medical and a broadcast experience and expertise.
Yes.
You are also a mother of four children, a wife, and we feel fortunate to have your show as part of our Monday morning programming here at KRFY. I also want to remind the listeners you can always find podcasts of each of our shows, Monday morning shows, at krfy.org.
Okay. As we start, I'd like to give a little bit of a history of National Mental Health Month. I find that, as I do my research, part of the interesting things that you can learn. National Mental Health Month has been observed in the U.S. since 1949. That makes it 75 years. The purpose is to inform the public of the many aspects of mental health to create both understanding and acceptance. Unfortunately, there always seems to be a stigma about mental health and treatment, and a belief that the public doesn't really understand mental illness. Some people who are affected actually don't want to be identified or labeled, and others do because they know that that's how they get services and perhaps treatment with medications. A little more background, which I found fascinating, was that the organization was initially called the National Committee for Mental Hygiene, and later called the National Mental Health Association, and finally Mental Health America. This organization was founded in 1909 by Mr. Clifford Beers. Beers was one of five children who all suffered from mental illness and spent time in a mental hospital. He suffered from bipolar disorder, which then was called manic depressive disorder. He initially developed his symptoms after the death of his brother from the same illness. Mr. Beers tried to commit suicide by jumping out of a third-story window, but survived, fortunately, because he then worked on this wonderful organization. He was a recent Yale graduate and Wall Street financer who was sent to three different mental hospitals, where he saw a cruel, inhumane, and abusive environment in all the hospitals. And the other interesting fact that I learned was that mental, and I sort of knew this because of when I grew up, but not exactly the complete statistic, mental health or mental hospitals were much more common during the first half of the 20th century. In fact, 50% of hospital beds in the 1950s were in mental hospitals, an entity the people in the U.S. now have rarely heard of. When Clifford Beers founded the National Committee for Mental Hygiene, its goals were very similar to the goals of today: to improve attitudes toward mental illness and people living with mental conditions, to improve services for people with mental health conditions, and to work for the prevention of mental illnesses and to promote mental health. So now I'm going to have our listener, tell a little bit more about themselves, too. Tell us, Dr. Wassef, about your prescribing psychologist licensing and its role at Kinnick-Sue Health.
Thanks, Dr. Joanne, and I appreciate you having us on your show. I recently joined Kinnick-Sue in early February of this past year. I was at Bonner General Behavioral Health for the previous about 6 years before joining Kinnick-Sue as their new director of psychiatry and ever expanding behavioral health department. I'm lucky to be joined here by Rob Rossi, who introduced himself in just a second. But the term prescribing psychologist, relatively new for the state of Idaho. It was a bill was passed in 2017 allowing psychologists with a doctorate to then have the opportunity to go back to school, obtain a postdoctorate master's in psychopharmacology, and then two additional years of training under a physician to then be able to prescribe medications for mental health disorders.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Some states have it and some states don't. I know that Ohio's been very strict in it. There are always bills, you know, in the legislature. Can a nurse practitioner prescribe mm-hmm. without a doctor's supervision? Can mm-hmm. a PA, psychologist even? So tell us a little bit more about your background, where you got your first degree, your initial degrees, I guess, and where you have worked.
Well, we may have some problems here, Dr. Joanne. I heard you say Ohio, and my alma mater is Penn State, so I worry about our Big Ten rivalry here. But my originally began with a degree in health and human studies and at Penn State University. It feels like a long time ago now. My goodness. And did most of my education on the East Coast. Got my first master's degree in education, actually, at the University of Georgia. Go Bulldogs! You'll see a theme here of large football institutions. So I'm not sure what that says about me, but fall is always a fun time.
Who just love to play Ohio State?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, this could be a very long conversation here. And I actually thought I was going to go more in the education route, and my subsequent doctorate, I started developing a research platform working with veterans in the trauma and actually an area called post-traumatic growth, and we could talk more about that later, but sort of the other side of trauma, after practicing. For a number of years, I ended up going back to school at West Virginia University and got a second master's degree in counseling and then a doctorate in psychology. And then, as we mentioned more recently, I think it's been 5-6 years, I went back to school and got my postdoctorate master's from Farley Dickinson University in New Jersey.
Okay. Yep. And how about Rob? Can you tell us a little bit about your duties there at Kinnick-Sue?
Yeah, so I'm a clinical therapist, and I work within the school systems through an arrangement with the Boundary County School District to provide services to kids who, for whatever reason, aren't able to receive services in the clinic. So Perhaps their parents are all working and or they don't have transportation. So meeting them in the schools allows me to reach a lot of kids who would otherwise not be able to receive services.
That's a wonderful, actually, service to go to the children. So again, lots of times we would have parents who wanted their child seen immediately, and I would get a special, you know, I'd call a friend and get a special appointment, and then they'd go, oh, I can't go there at this time of day or that time of day. So that solves that problem, certainly. Mm-hmm. I'm going to just give a few statistics about mental health, and then we'll get into talking about the specific programs at Kiniksu. It was interesting, in last week's Reader, our community paper, there was a very short article about depression and some interesting statistics. About 5 to 6% of the entire U.S. population, or about 1 in 20, experience a serious mental illness each year. So this article noted that with our county population of 64,759, their estimate would be that about 4,000 people in Bonner and Boundary County have some serious mental illness. Just really, you know, frightening, and I'm sure it creates a lot of work for you all. Diagnosis could be schizophrenia, bipolar disease, severe PTSD. And then the National Institute of Mental Health also estimates that 21 million adults, so the other statistic was all people, and this is 20 million adults, or 8.3% of all adults, had at least one episode of major depression in 2021. And prescriptions for antidepressants increased by 35% in the last 6 years. So now we know, now our listeners know why mental health is such a huge concern. Any questions that you have, Susie? Comments?
I just think it's really great that we're focusing on this, and I'm interested to hear what our two guests have to say about some of the stuff you just mentioned, the statistics, and how we can support our community for mental health.
Okay.
Yeah, so, I could actually. Yeah. Yeah, there's a couple of things that I wanted to comment on, if that's okay.
If you
think about the statistics that you were quoting are probably national averages, and in places like Sandpoint, you would actually find that the numbers are even higher, and that has a lot to do with rural areas. There are some correlations that just naturally go hand in hand with greater issues of mental health concerns in rural areas when people have greater or more difficult times with access to care. That's also associated with greater mental health concerns. The financial discrepancy and actually Schweitzer Ski Mountain recently did a really nice job bringing the community together to talk about this from another perspective of being a resort town and the unique mental health issues associated with being in towns like this. And part of that has to do with the financial discrepancy that comes with some folks having quite a bit of resources and other folks not. And the attraction and allure of a big ski town with a big lake. But then there's another side of the equation that often gets overlooked.
Did you all watch the Paradox in Paradise, movie?
I was a panel speaker.
You were? Mm-hmm. Oh, wonderful. Yeah. It was interesting to be in that movie. It mainly was around Vail and Eagle County. But that some of the people were what you were talking about, the people who come in and work for lower paying jobs because they really want to be here, and then they are faced with housing costs and food costs and all the costs. And some were people who grew up there, but again, it's their advancement and, you know, how they saw themselves or not advancing and were having their own stresses. So I was thinking it was going to be all the employees of mountain towns, but it really was about the whole community and how they needed better psychological care in areas such as this. So the therapists you have available are, I assume, licensed professional counselors, family counselors, PhDs, PsyDs.
We don't currently have a PsyD, but that's not to say... Mm-hmm. That won't happen in the future. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Do you use different treatment modalities, like mainly the traditional counseling, listening, and kind of formulating plans with patients, or what are your usual treatment modalities?
It really depends on the provider. So each provider has their own license, their own background. Mm-hmm. And so part of our clinical meetings can be figuring out who's best to serve somebody in particular with particular needs. Working in the schools with all ages, I have a background in play therapy and working with teens, troubled teens from having worked in wilderness therapy. And so, yeah, we all bring our own unique talents to the table.
Right. So let's get into the different diagnoses you see. Or do you have any idea statistically, Joe, how the patients, you know, the percentage of each diagnosis you have in the at Kiniksu Community Health?
You know, that's actually a great question. I haven't been there long enough to get into the statistics of based on diagnoses. Okay. I know my current panel because I've worked with several of my folks for years and years and years. And so I tend to treat more folks with, you know, complicated bipolar diagnoses, schizophrenia, chronic or treatment resistant depression. But on the flip side, I actually, you know, cut my teeth, so to speak, with the pediatric population. Mm-hmm. And so that's a whole other end of the spectrum of, like, folks just coming to the table and helping parents sort of understand diagnoses and helping them access treatment. Trying to, because before I was a prescriber, I did a lot of neuropsych testing, right? And so I bring that to my practice, even though a majority of my current role is either as an administrator or a prescriber. You can't unlearn the things that you previously utilized. So I will still use different measures to be able to identify, is this an intellectual deficit that I'm seeing in front of me that you can't just assess through talking, or is this an autism diagnosis? And so I'm able to more readily identify childhood mental health issues a little bit faster.
So how is a referral done? The parents call because they're concerned. The teacher tells the parent that they're concerned.
Yeah, it's a great question.
Is that usually they can just call, or does their physician, whether it be a family doc, a nurse practitioner, or a pediatrician, have to make the referral?
So for the in-school therapist, so there is an in-school therapist also, Stacy, in Bonner County. For the population I work with, they come through the school counselors. And so if their pediatrician has concerns, they might share that concern with me, or they'll have their parent contact the school counselor. I would say about half of the kids that I end up working with come to me because of an initial complaint of suicidal ideation and self-harm.
Okay.
And I think a lot of that has to do with a lot of stigma around mental health issues. And so kids don't know that they can talk about their problems. And then it gets to a point where they feel desperate and they start to have these thoughts that they don't know how to cope. And so usually within a few sessions, we can figure out this is really not about wanting to commit suicide. This is about needing an outlet. This is about needing tools to cope with the stress in your life.
It's really interesting. Yeah. The different diagnoses often apply to, depending if you're a young child or I'm sure you see people from being young children on to geriatrics.
Mm-hmm.
What about COVID? A lot of people now are talking about how mental health problems have increased since COVID, and especially since, I might say, 2007, when the iPhone came out, when, social media basically and mobile devices. So either one of you want to attack that, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
for the kids that I'm seeing, a lot of them don't recognize that COVID really impacted them. They just don't have a window to a lens to see that through, right? They are kids during it. So in talking with them, they'll discover, oh, okay, I spent a few years isolated. I spent a few years with parents who are really stressed out. And so there's a lot of subtle things that we can't just point to oftentimes that lead to increased stress in the family, which kids tend to then take on themselves, and they might act out. I particularly like working with angry teenagers. That's my go-to. That's what I'm familiar with. But they're acting out because the family is trying to hold in all this stress and keep it all together. And so the kids end up becoming that vent for the family stress.
Interesting. I've also thought about or read that teenagers might self-diagnose because of all this social media. So they hear or see someone else being stressed. And so is that good or bad? Does that help them come to the realization that maybe they do need to talk to someone? Or does that make them, again, so stressed that those are the kids that attempt suicide?
It comes and goes, and depends also on what shows are popular. you know, I can usually tell if a new show comes out that I'm going to have a few more people claiming to have this or that issue. And so in one way in which it's good is kids are thinking, okay, this isn't normal, and they're trying to look around and see, well, what might this be? Mm-hmm. You know, unfortunately, it's not they don't get a very wide picture of what is going on for them. So, you know, I do a lot of giving a diagnosis of an adjustment disorder because things like dissociation, we used to worry about a whole lot, but in kids, that's the brain being a brain. You know, hearing voices and whatnot. For kids, again, that's oftentimes creativity and imagination. So I like to try and destigmatize from the start. You know, let's just talk openly about these things. What benefits do you get from these? And so the benefits, going back to your question, would be that it can get them in the door. The downside is sometimes they're so attached to that diagnosis they've given themselves that it can be hard to work around it.
Interesting.
I think that was really well said, Rob, because I think it depends on the practitioner, how they, you know, sometimes as a provider, when someone comes in and they have an idea and you're like, oh my goodness, I've got to now unravel this. But to your point, however people come to the table and they want to have a discussion about mental health and they're there because they want help, I'm just glad that they're there, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and then there's time to talk about why the whatever information they receive. You know, I definitely have a lot of people that will tell me, like, yeah, I learned about this survey on TikTok, and I must have ADHD, and I'm like, well, maybe, and let's talk about that. And I don't necessarily, I mean, it's kind of funny, but it's also like, it brings awareness that maybe actually this person really does have some struggles. And then we can then dive more into, valid measures that can assess what is actually going on for that person. So I'm glad that they're there.
That's interesting, because when I was in pediatric practice, I've heard psychologists at certain meetings, like the pediatrician or family doc would write, prescription, diagnose ADHD or something. Mm-hmm. And they're going, well, we can't do that, but we have to first do some psychoeducational neuropsych testing, mm-hmm. to know what if they have a learning disability that's right. Making them inattentive. So mm-hmm. really what the pediatrician meant is rule out other things so that mm-hmm. then we can make them, you know, can put the correct label on them or the correct diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Alcohol and drug use, how much is that a part of the patients you see? I know when I first came to town, methamphetamine was a big deal, and there were billboards all over about the use of methamphetamine, and all the babies were tested who were born at Bonner General for if they had drugs in their system. comments.
That's a big conversation right there. Yeah. It took a big breath because I'm like, where do I start with this?
Yeah.
I will say, yes, it's certainly a component. It's not the only component of what we see, but you know, we're really, really lucky to have a certified addiction counselor working at Kinnexu Deb. She's amazing. We have a number of practitioners that help support our community through medical assistant treatment for, you know, buprenorphine, Subutex, you know, medications like that to help with the treatment for substance use disorders, naltrexone and alike. And I've got my hats off to the powers that be that decided, let's try to remove barriers to care. And now that, you know, folks with a DEA license are now tasked with completing at least an 8-hour training for medically assisted treatment for substance use. So it allows anybody with a DEA license in the future to be able to provide improve access to care for these medications.
Could you define DEA license for our listeners?
Yeah. So anybody that has the ability to prescribe medications, right? So there's a formulary, a list of things that is within their scope of care. So like, for instance, myself, I only prescribe medications related to mental health disorders or the treatment of, you know, side effects associated with it.
You can't write amoxicillin for my ear infection.
You don't want me treating your diabetes or anything like that. I'm gonna stay within a pretty narrow scope of care. But as it relates to what I was talking about before, the goal has been some of these medications that I mentioned before, buprenorphine. They are so valuable for folks that need them. Right. Not everybody needs these medications, but folks that have been struggling with opiate use disorders, things of the like, it was a real, real struggle to find access to care. And that's becoming easier and easier.
So that's improving here. Mm-hmm. Then there's, you know, three diagnoses that are kind of together, depression and bipolar or manic depressive disorder. When I was in med school and things, we had our neuroses and our psychoses, according to your, and those were more in the neuroses, the neurotic category. So, you know, pure depression or bipolar, I assume a good number of your patients have those diagnoses. And even then OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, how it relates to perhaps some other things. Let's start with the depression and bipolar.
What would you like to know?
mainly, again, how common it is. How are there signs and symptoms that their relatives, their friends should recognize that might encourage someone to seek help?
Yeah, so if you have a friend who is not as interested in doing things with you or doing things that they enjoyed, maybe they're isolating. You know, those are probably the signs that are easiest to spot for a friend or a family member. It's fairly difficult to tell if somebody is just having a bad day or a bad week, or if they really need additional support. But in general, the antidote for a lot of these issues can be belonging. It can be having a community that you can be a part of, be with, where you don't have to be having a good day to fit in, you know, where you're just accepted for who you are. So we're doing a lot of work in particular right now. We have a lot more groups that we're trying to establish at our Sandpoint location for people to just have that community.
So again, that also spans the age groups from younger children up through geriatrics. I would say, I guess, joie de vivre. They've lost their joie de vivre. Mm-hmm. They may be crying more often or just not getting up off the couch to do anything. And again, that can be a result of COVID too. I mean, some people were so afraid to go outside that it's really interesting that some of it's carried over.
Dr. Joanne, I guess I want to comment on the bipolar diagnosis, because it's fairly complex, right? Yeah. And I forget the most recent statistic, but it's multiple years in which a person is misdiagnosed, usually with bipolar disorder, because you think about the diagnosis or the symptomatology associated with the diagnosis, rather. A vast majority of folks with a bipolar diagnosis spend their time more in that depressive state than in the manic or hypomanic state. And so most of the time when they're presenting for care, it can be easily misdiagnosed for depression, right? Like unipolar depression. And so, they can go many, many years. And it's oftentimes not until something more severe, when there's that classic presentation of mania, that it's clear that something else is going on. And that's where, helping our primary care providers and then just the public, at large to understand this diagnosis better, so that we can be more understanding and good community members to recognize, hey, something else is going on. Why is it that this person, for 2 weeks, for 1 week, is now all of a sudden not sleeping and behaving atypically or erratically and spending money that they wouldn't normally do, or talking really fast, and that's not their normal baseline? And to ask questions and not just assume, hey, this person may be using drugs or something along the lines, that actually maybe there's something else going on.
So are they usually diagnosed in their depressive phase and then the manic comes, or are they diagnosed when they're manic?
Well, a lot of times, right, and it does vary, but a lot of times people are first diagnosed with a depressive disorder, right? And what we know is that some of the medications that are used for depression actually can exacerbate the bipolar symptomatology, right? So it can make the ups and downs happen either faster or actually contribute to the development of hypomania mania.
So you were really down and then suddenly you're, whoa! You're redoing your whole house.
That's right.
Well, it's time to say that you are listening to 88.5 KRFY Community Radio for North Idaho. We also call it 88.5 Pondere.
And we are listening to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne, and we're talking with
Dr. Wassef and Rob Rosso. Okay. You talked, Rob, a bit about anger management. So again, those are the patients that we've always had trouble with. Anger management, explosive personalities, that also I know interfaces with bullying at school. So can you talk a little bit about those problems?
Yeah. So there is a lot of anger coming out for kids who don't have an outlet for their stress. And, tying in back into depression, we talk about how does depression show up in populations. Well, in teenagers like to rebel. So they don't always look like the, moping, hiding their feelings, typical depression. Sometimes they look like more of an anxiety disorder, where they're explosive anger and irritability. And so it can be hard to diagnose what's the difference between that and normal teenage, aggression, or a normal teenage, not aggression, but development, where you're the part of your brain goes offline for you to stay calm and cool, because normally we would need to jump into adulthood, right? So the anxiety, it can show up in a lot of ways. We have kids that will act in, and we have kids that will act out. And so trying to determine, is this a depression? Is this an anxiety disorder? or is there something else going on? A lot of times what looks like ADHD, for example, could be a post-traumatic expression. It could be some other neurodevelopmental expression. So when I have kids that come in and they're really angry, you know, the first thing I try to do is make their anger welcome. You know, let's become friends with our anger. Let's figure out why is it important for you to be here. Usually when kids feel like their anger is heard, when they their struggle is validated, a lot of that anger goes away. A lot of that anger is really used to fuel them getting their needs met.
Okay. Do you find that the parents, I mean, it's certainly such a intersection of the parent's personality and the child's personality. I've always said to my patients, it's when your expectations aren't met by their behavior, you have a problem. I mean, you may have a problem. So are there a lot of parents, can you tell that? How long does it take to tell that the parents are not as supportive as they could be?
So I think I've got a lot of parents who wish they could be more supportive. And again, I'm working with a unique population where they're not able to, you know, bring their child into the clinic or show up for a lot of their appointments. And so it can be really difficult. To varying degrees, you have parents who will come in and say, fix my kid. And you have to tell them, I'm sorry, I can't fix what's not broken. They're angry because the anger is doing something. Oftentimes I'm working with those kids on, okay, let's accept the reality that, you know, you don't have the parents that you wish you had. But that said, I think the more that we can include parents in the discussions, the more that we can destigmatize the mental health so that parents feel like they can be more of a part of it, where they don't feel like, oh, it's my fault. You know, the intergenerational trauma that goes through small towns in rural communities, it takes generations. And so oftentimes I'm working with families on accepting that you're doing something really brave and really difficult, which is to put the brakes on intergenerational trauma.
Okay.
Dr. Joanne, I have a question or a comment
sure.
on some of this. Social media can be very traumatic for teenagers, we'll say, and possibly even younger. It can send them, something can happen, and it can send them into a charged anxiety. And I'm wondering about, maybe you've mentioned this already and I didn't catch it, but tools for parents to kind of smooth that over and work with their student child to mitigate, bring it down to this is temporary, tomorrow is a new day. I know that the counselors at the high school work with this and help, you know, maybe have parenting classes or something. What do you say? How can parents find tools to help their children balance the social media charge that can happen?
And even the cyberbullying.
Yeah.
Great questions. Really good questions. I'll start the conversation, but I'm going to really look to Rob, who's in the schools working with children every single day to continue this conversation. So cyberbullying, it's a really big deal. And so just to think about it from this perspective, bullying has been around for forever, right? Like this isn't a new topic, but the way in which we think about bullying is changing, right? So bullying used to be something that we kind of think of in the school system, right? That happens in the classroom, but then when you go home, at least then you get away from it. Cyberbullying, you don't really get away from it, right? So you may experience something at school or something gets posted while you're at school, then you go home and you read it. And so it just continues, right? And so really having conversations about this topic as a family unit, I can't I can't stress it enough. It's really important. So some of the conversations that I have with parents and young people is first of all being able to take a break from those things. And as the younger the population, the more I would encourage parents to have restrictions on which websites or which social media websites that they have access to. And when they are getting on these things, if that's even a decision the family chooses to make, how to do so in a safe manner, and what are the risks, and how do you identify the risks, and who do you tell when there are risks, and there's a lot to it. So there's a whole nother conversation that needs to happen. We used to think about, again, stranger danger was a different kind of topic when we were just worried about the people that you would interact in person throughout your life. But now having that conversation in the context of a social online environment changes the conversation. So, Rob, you want to add to that?
Yeah, in addition to, the cyberbullying happens 24/7, it also makes it seem universal where used to, back in my day, you'd get into a tuffle and, maybe some names would be called, but then
get tripped on the playground repeatedly.
right. Yeah. And now it's, if that happens, people don't just spread tales about it. They share the link. Right. And so you have this theory that, or this feeling like the whole world can see this and it's there forever, that everyone now knows what happened. So it is very immediate. It brings things home very quickly and it follows you around. So mm-hmm. It's much more insidious than the playground bullying of my youth. As far as ways that parents can help, it's really hard to turn this boat around. The bigger the boat, the harder it is to turn around. So starting young on sharing, like watching what your kids are watching on TV, being able to talk about things that we're watching or observing, so that we get into the habit of being open about those kind of things is important. When it comes to sharing, giving a child a phone or access to the internet, it's tempting to take your old phone and give it to your kid, but we really need to be careful, what do they have access to. So the safest thing would be for parents to have programs on the phone where the any photos that are taken get shared with parents, any texts that get received get shared with parents, and having the conversation that this is about building trust but also providing protection. And in particular, sharing, if you ever feel like you're pressured into doing something, you have the outlet of blaming mom and dad, right? Throw mom and dad under the bus and say, oh man, if I do that, they're going to get the link and then I'm going to be grounded. Then I can't hang out with you. So having those conversations, allowing your kid to be mad at you for putting restrictions on and, allowing them to vent that anger that, hey, I want more autonomy. That's a good thing that they want more autonomy, and it's okay to be the parent and for your kids to be upset with you sometimes.
Yeah, thank you. Just one quick thing about schizophrenia, because that's, again, getting more in the psychotic break area. Do you start with these patients and then have to refer them, or what happens if you have a very psychotic patient?
Yeah, I guess it depends on where they are and how severe the presentation is. I mean, that's these are the folks that I treat every single day, right? It's important to recognize that medication is just one aspect of the treatment. Like, I'm really grateful to be partners with NAMI and sit on their board. The other, community health agencies within the community also, treat folks with schizophrenia, right? So there's multiple different resources. If it's a first psychotic break, Oftentimes that is a medical emergency, and we want to treat it as such, and to understand, is this a mental health disorder? Is there something else going on? Right. But every single day, those are the folks that we treat.
Suicide are obviously so traumatic for both the survivors and any witnesses. And one area that's gotten publicity is young adults who are triggered by high expectations they put on themselves or their parents or their teachers put on them. I don't know if either one of you have read the book Run, Maddie, Run, but it was about a girl from New Jersey who went to UPenn, and she was a great soccer player and a runner, and she decided she would just run. And for some reason, after Christmas of, I can't remember if it's her freshman year or sophomore year, she jumps off a 7-story garage. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of, reportings of things like that happening at colleges across the country. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things we always ask as a practitioner was, have you ever thought of, committing suicide or doing away with yourself? So, how do you work with suicide prevention, and do they come to you? I can't say before, but obviously, can you tell who might be most at risk?
So there are things that you can notice about somebody that tells you that they're at risk. A lot of the things that you would identify as depressive, isolation, significant mood swings, a big one would be giving things away. That kind of tells you somebody's not really invested in their stuff for a while. One of the ways that I try to work with kids early on, and I think we were talking about this earlier in the program, is demystifying that suicidal ideation is something we all have. We've all had thoughts of suicide, but it's usually, what would that be like, right? It's not, I want to do it. Mm-hmm. Our brain goes into autopilot, and it thinks of the worst case scenarios in order for us to figure out a plan to deal with those scenarios. And so it's important to know that our thoughts aren't real. It's not our brain telling us to do things, but we need to be able to talk about it earlier than later. The more that we allow those thoughts to happen, the more that becomes a pattern, and we end up with anxiety. We end up with dissociation and suicidal ideation. Things like self-harm are also a really great indicator. It's the best method that the child has to release some pain or energy. And so trying to talk about what are the benefits to the self-harm. What are the benefits you would see if you did commit suicide? We worry oftentimes that it means that we're crazy to have those thoughts, and it's not that we're crazy. It's normal. It's that we're concerned, that we're worried. Mm-hmm. And so being able to talk about, hey, this is where I would have to draw the line. As a therapist, you have confidentiality up to a point. And when it comes to suicide, it's about having a plan and starting to follow that plan. And this is where, parents and teachers, school counselors, friends, the more you learn about suicide prevention, the more we can be an ear to listen rather than a potential hazard, right? I don't want to bring this up and end up having to go to the hospital. Mm-hmm. There's also a great resource, the 988 number, and that's for people that are not only experiencing suicidal ideation, but also any significant mental health issue.
Okay. The next one, we may not have much time to do this, but PTSD is so prevalent in, John and I just watched a couple of the World War II movies, and you're watching the Pacific and going, oh my gosh, how can anyone be, quote, normal coming back from a situation like that? Or it could be that a child a person was raped as a child and they have that memory, or they see someone being abused physically or mentally. or the traumatic death of a parent, or the parent has committed suicide. How many patients do you treat with PTSD, or is that just so pervasive it's part of almost everything?
It's a great question. and our understanding of PTSD has really changed over the years. I was thinking about back in World War II, what was the vernacular around it? And I think it was shell shock, and I forget what it was in World War I. But we've had some understanding of this diagnosis for a very, very long time. How kind we are to people with it has changed over the years. And the treatments obviously have expanded, and there's several evidence based treatments now. EMDR, was quite big for a very long time, still is. Cognitive behavioral therapy, trauma focused trauma CBT. I use a lot of cognitive processing therapy, exposure therapy. There's multiple different modalities to help folks with PTSD, but because of my dissertation was in this area, I tend to see a lot through that lens. And even if someone, it doesn't meet full criteria, that you sometimes see a lot of like a subclinical PTSD. In the mental health world, we talk about big T and little T's. So big T's are the classic traumas that we think of, abuse or, surviving, some kind of near death incident, something along those lines. Those are the big T's, but, we forget about the multiple, I'm sorry.
No, I'm just saying there are lots of little T's.
That's the little T's that we sometimes forget about that compound, especially when you're younger.
Poverty, endemic stress, disability, living in a war zone.
Mm-hmm. And when you add all these things up, they're very traumatic, right? Mm-hmm. And so sometimes they get overmissed because you can just ask, like, have you experienced this, this, and this? And they'll say, no, I haven't. So, okay, so you don't have trauma. But actually, if you look at the symptomatology, are you having nightmares, flashbacks, changed negative view of self, other, in the world, things along those lines? Absolutely, they would meet criteria for PTSD. So it's quite prevalent, but it's also hard to
we could have a whole show on PTSD.
Yeah.
So just to finish up, what do you envision for Kiniksu Health in the psychology realm and our mental health services over the next 5, 10, 15 years?
I'm really glad that you asked that question because I'm excited about being at Kiniksu. I'm excited about the things that we're doing. And actually, this gives me an opportunity to talk about what's called the CCBHC, or Community-Based Healthcare Center. And the services at Kiniksu as of April 1st have changed, right? And so what that means is that in order to access psychiatric care at Kiniksu, you previously had to be an established patient of one of our primary care providers. But as of April 1st, folks can now be referred to our psychiatric department. And there's myself and two psychiatric nurse practitioners from outside referrals. So, the folks at the Family Health Center and Mountain View Medical and Applegate and all these folks around town now have the ability to refer directly to us. Still need a referral from primary care for psychiatry, but can see us. Folks can self-refer or have referrals from providers to access our counseling team. And we, as part of a grant that we recently received to become a CCBHC, we've now started case management as well as peer support services.
So if I was a parent or a teacher and and I had a student, would you do the educational testing, or do they have get it done in the schools?
That would be a conversation. So
short.
So it, yes, I have the capability of doing that, but my day to day doesn't necessarily allow me to do the full battery testing that it once did. But I will say that if a young person is in school, and they're wondering about a potential learning disability, they should absolutely, the parents should absolutely talk to their school administrator to find out, would my kid qualify for testing? Because there are different qualifications, but there are resources in our community. And I hope to be able to announce more about neuropsych testing in the future.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being here. I really enjoyed our conversation. Like I said, I think we could talk about PTSD for an hour itself.
Yeah.
And, you know, school evaluations.
I think what's important to what I gathered from this conversation is we're very fortunate to have Kinnexu Health Services and the expansion of what came in April 1st and good counselors in the school. You know, our children need to be cared for to start. So that's great.
And other providers in the area, you know, this is, we're trying to work ourselves out of a job here, right? If you, you know, if it's not Kinnexu, go somewhere, get the help you need. There's a lot of good support out there.
Good message.
So again, I had with me Dr. Joseph Wassef, PhD, head of psychiatry at Bonner Community Health, and Rob
Rossi.
Rossi. Okay. I do better when I've seen something written down. Rossi, who works in Boundary County with the schools for Kinnexu. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you all for listening. Please do remember this is a medical information show. It does not substitute for discussing your concerns with your medical provider. Please listen next month where we'll be that will be on June 3rd when we'll be discussing the great outdoors. And my guests will be Carol Jenkins and Tom Dabrowski. Again, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next month.